All right. Hello and welcome to the mystery thriller session we're calling The Butler Did It. I'm WBUR senior business reporter Callum Borchers. And as my attempt at a Boston accent suggests, we're joined today by four authors with Boston ties about their mystery thriller novels set in the Boston area. Please allow me to introduce our guests. Kate Reculia has one of the most interesting resumes I've ever seen. Two jobs that jump out at me are cartoonist and planetarium operator.
Oh, yes.
We'll have to talk about that later. Yes. These days, she works at the Bethlehem Area Public Library in Pennsylvania, but she got her MFA here at Emerson College, and she teaches online for Boston-based Grub Street, which is a creative writing center for aspiring authors and published authors who want to get even better. Kate's leading by example with her own novels, and her latest is Tuesday Mooney Talks to Ghosts, right behind her. You can see it. Which has received starred reviews in Publishers Weekly and Kirkus Reviews. Please welcome Kate Reculia. Edwin Hill also earned an MFA from Emerson College. Apparently, that's a good program. They had a booth outside. You should go check it out. He's originally from Duxbury and now lives in Roslindale, my old neighborhood. He's the former vice president and editorial director of the textbook publisher Bedford St. Martin's. Now, he's a full-time novelist. He's the author of the Hester Thursby mystery series, and the latest is called The Missing Ones, which has received starred reviews in Publishers Weekly and Booklist. Please welcome Edwin Hill. If you're like me, you first became familiar with Hank Phillippe Ryan as the on-air investigative reporter for Channel 7, WHDH-TV here in Boston. She's won 36 Emmys, 14 Edward R. Murrow Awards, and dozens of other honors, which means she has more trophies than the Patriots, Celtics, Red Sox, and Bruins combined. She is also a best-selling author of 11 mystery novels, which have added to her trophy collection. 5 Agathas, 3 Anthonys, 2 Macavities, the Daphne, the coveted Mary Higgins Clark Award, and her newest book is the psychological thriller, The Murder List, which CNN named the ultimate beach read. Now, beach season is over, but Library Journal's starred review calls it a riveting must-read without any seasonal qualifier. So it's definitely not too late to enjoy. Please welcome Hank Phillippe Ryan. And Adam Abramowitz is a Boston native and UMass Boston alum. He, too, has a fascinating resume that includes stints as a courier, bartender, doorman, and mover. Lift with your legs, right?
And hope for the best.
And hope for the best. Good. He's teaching these days in Mount Vernon, New York, but we can forgive that because he still spends a lot of time here in Northfield, Massachusetts. He's the author of the Bosstown novel series, Total Commitment. Show us the tat, right? I mean, you got to look at this. Full commitment authors right there. The latest is A Town Called Malice. One reviewer calls it wildly unique and raves, this brave new take on a traditional genre is captivating, hilarious, and darkly brilliant. Hey, Hank, who wrote that review? Hank Phillippe Ryan is that reviewer. Please welcome Adam Abramowitz. All right, so I alluded a moment ago to Boston's many sports championships. We got the head of the Charles this weekend. We got the marathon in the spring. We like to be known as a successful sports town. We're also known for our many world-class academic institutions. And yet you all seem to see something else as well in our fair city, or at least our region. Apparently, it's also the perfect setting for mystery thriller novels. So I'd like to know from each of you, and maybe, Kate, you can start. You're on the end. Why is the Boston area such a rich place for this genre?
That is a great question. I know from my perspective, so I was born in Syracuse, New York, and when I moved here, it was the biggest city I'd ever lived in. So there is just such a diversity of people and places and experiences, and anytime you get that kind of density of human variety, you will find mysteries, right? You will find the opportunity to like misread something or find a clue or go down a rabbit hole you've never gone before. Also, Boston is super old. And, like, history, to me, is full of mysteries. You're trying to uncover things. So that was my mysterious attraction, I think.
Edwin, why is Boston, or the Boston area at least, a good mystery thriller setting?
I think a couple of things.
things that I agree that it's beautiful and it's historical, mm-hmm. so it makes your job easier.
Oh, yeah.
One of the things I really love about the Boston area as a crime writer is that you can go from very, very urban to a different type of setting very quickly
yep.
and very easily, and there's a lot to choose from. So my first book was set on Beacon Hill and in Somerville, but I also set a lot of the action in the Lakes region of New Hampshire, which is gorgeous. And in the second book, I set a lot of the action on an island off the coast of Maine. And so it was just very easy to kind of move around and pick and choose yep. what I needed for the story.
And in mystery, so much about mysteries and thrillers and psychological thrillers, the ones that I write, are so much about motivation and what people want and how far they'll go to get it. And people in Boston are smart and competitive and motivated, and you know they go after what they want. I mean, look at the sports teams. Yeah. As you say, we want to win, and winning is such a key element of my books. You know, I also love the settings are so gorgeous and fabulous and recognizable. In one of my books, my husband and I will be driving down the Mass Pike, and I'll say, oh, this is where Jane was chased by the bad guy. And then I think, no, I made that up. You know, that didn't really happen here. But I love to do that. I love when people say, oh, I've been there at the State House. I've seen that staircase. I've seen that stained glass window. And I think that recognition of that I have been there and I have seen that and that could really have happened there and I didn't know it yeah. can make a huge difference in a book.
There often is that intersection, right, between ambition and crime, right? We have this smart, ambitious city, but look at the Varsity Blues case that's coming out of our U.S. District Attorney's office, right? I
mean, well, that's what can happen if you push it too far, right?
Yeah.
Adam, why is Boston a good crime town, or a good, well, I guess that is sort of, you know, a town called Malice. It's very, very, very on the nose. Why is this such a good town for that?
Well, for a couple of reasons. We know where to bury our dead, first of all. And the big dig really was the place that we stored most of the bodies. Boston is turf-driven. Neighborhoods were protected, or very clannish as a city. We've had a lot of division in the city. Especially in the past. So when one came up against the other, there was a lot of friction.
Hank, I want to turn back to you for a minute. So the latest book is called The Murder List. Could you just explain for folks what that is, if they're not familiar with the term? It sounds like maybe somebody's hit list. It's not a list of people you want to murder. It's something else. But in your case, what are you talking about?
Well, it's interesting because I love to have all my titles mean multiple things, have layers. But the true murder list, the one that is the list of lawyers who are experienced and savvy and wise enough and benevolent enough to be appointed by the state to represent those who are accused of murder who can't afford a good lawyer. So the state believes that everybody deserves the best possible defense, and that is called the murder list, the people on those lawyers on the list. And my husband is on the list, so it was wonderful to have it's good to have in-house counsel. But it also
tell me about that, though, because I didn't know that when I started reading. And then it made a lot of sense as I read, because you seem to have such command of the subject, and I thought, oh, she at least has some, if not firsthand, secondhand, close secondhand knowledge of what that world must be like. I mean, how valuable is that when you're writing convincing fiction?
To have in-house counsel is pretty great. I mean, as it turned out, you know, how you sort of have a writing rhythm every day. Every day at about 3, I would call my husband and say, sweetheart, I have the legal question of the day. But what I wanted to do, and what I've heard people say about the sort of verisimilitude of the lawyer world in Boston and about crime and justice in Boston, is that, as I was saying, it's all about winning and how far a really good prosecutor would go to win and how far a really good defense attorney would go to win. And it's all about knowing the rules and who can tell the best story and who can tell the best story in the right and most persuasive way to convince a jury when that prosecutor and that defense attorney probably hate each other, you know, on the playing field of that courtroom. And that's a big conflict, especially when it's instantly life or death. It's instantly life-changing. You know, when my husband would say to defend someone who you really think did not do it, if they get convicted, you know, my husband says, I go home and have a martini, and my client goes to prison. So it's just the most gut-wrenching, high-stakes situation that you can possibly make, which of course is perfect for crime fiction.
Mm-hmm. Did everyone notice how deftly Hank wove verisimilitude into the sentence? You've been spending a lot of time with the lawyers.
You guys are playing bingo, you could
You can check that one off. So you have even more personal experience, though, obviously, as a reporter. And I'm a reporter, so perhaps this stood out to me as I was reading your book. I was curious about the way you would describe TV reporters in your book. So I want to steer clear of spoilers here, but I do want to read one little bit here. I'll keep it general. There's a crime scene in your book where you describe reporters lurking inside their TV vans. And then there's this passage. The door to one of the TV vans opens. Two black pumps emerge, followed by two tanned legs, and then the short-skirted body and celebrated hair of Clea Rourke, the face of Channel 3. So I'm curious, Hank, whether this is a commentary on the superficial way that TV reporters are sometimes seen by others, or are you yourself critiquing TV news in a way?
Uh-huh. Good question.
Both, I believe. Both and. Okay.
I do think that this is another way of describing the balance. I mean, my books are cat and mouse games. You know, two people fighting against each other psychologically. So is Clea Rourke... Here's the thing about it. You're so funny. Nobody's ever asked me that. We are seeing Clea Rourke through the eyes of another character, one of the three main characters, Rachel North. Rachel North has an agenda, and we are in that scene only seeing Clea Rourke through Rachel's eyes. So I'm writing what Rachel thinks of her. When you see Clea Rourke in other parts of the book, through another person's point of view, she'll be something completely different. And that's what I try to do in the books by having multiple points of view, allow you to see the same person through other people's vision, and then you as the reader, sort of the jury, can put together who that person really is. So we know as much about Rachel, the person who's calling her the black pumps, tanned legs, celebrated hair. We know as much about Rachel, the person who's saying it, as we might know about Clea.
So that's one Boston. Adam, your book obviously also takes place in Boston, but if folks didn't know that at the outset, they might think you were talking about a completely different city from the one that Hank describes. This is not the Boston occupied by high-powered attorneys. Your protagonist is a bicycle courier who roams some pretty rough neighborhoods. Is that your own Boston experience coming through?
So it's very much my own Boston experience. I would say that Boston used to really cultivate and welcome screw-ups. It was a city that you can actually kind of come into your own and not have a real job like a reporter and a teacher. So Boston was a completely different city back when I grew up. And my character, Zesty Myers, kind of navigates that world. It's a different world. It's a different Boston that exists right now. It was a much grittier place. It was actually dangerous in certain neighborhoods. You needed to know where you were at all times, because once you cross that border, it might not look any different, but they look differently at you. So a very different kind of Boston.
I think in that vein, too, I mean, it's hard to miss reading your book, this sort of running commentary on gentrification that I think is woven throughout. And I was hoping that you would read for us this short excerpt. This is from early on in the book, but I will try to avoid the spoilers, but this is an early passage that comes through the protagonist's eyes here. This is Zesty Myers speaking, and I'll let Adam pick it up here.
Sure. And Zesty is thinly veiled. What I'm about to read, I actually live there. This is wholly accurate. When I had moved onto Thayer Street, it had no lighting. The road was dirt, mud when it rained. The loading docks and sidewalks littered with condom, crack vials, spent needles, and trash from contractors who had dumped their waste at all hours of the night. The Pine Street Inn, the city's largest homeless shelter on Harrison Avenue, was within view of my windows. Now that the big dig's been completed, the artists, musicians, and misfits who'd inhabited the rough industrial lofts either evicted or bought out, this once neglected outer edge of the South End rebranded as a historic district, Thayer Street has been reborn with art galleries, a cobblestone path, well-lit sidewalks, high-end restaurants and condominiums with sandblasted red brick exteriors that start in the seven figures, none of which I could afford.
So what's your take on that? I mean, I don't think anybody wants to see the crack vials and needles just lying around. But on the other hand, I also sense a bit of wistfulness when you describe this.
There's a lot of wistfulness. I actually cry when I go back. when I visit the South End. It's not that progress has necessarily been a negative. It's just it hasn't been really equally distributed. So there's a certain energy and a vibrancy that and danger that came along with it in the city that's just no longer there. And it's beautiful, and it's good for some people. It's not good for everybody.
Edwin. The Missing Ones is set on an island off the coast of Maine, so it's not Boston per se, but it's the kind of beautiful tourist town that I think is part of the Boston experience, at least for people with some disposable income. It's seemingly the perfect place, but of course your protagonist, Tester Thursby, discovers that it's anything but. I guess my question is, did you have a bad experience on the vineyards or something? I mean, what is up with this sort of dark version of the charming New England vacation town?
Oh, that's an interesting question. You know, that's part of your job as a crime writer is to come up with something terrible to happen. So my novel is set, part of it's set in Somerville. That's where Hester and her partner Morgan live. But the vast majority of the action takes place on an island off the coast of Maine. I started researching for this book maybe a year and a half ago. And I went to a beautiful place called Monhegan Island, which is 8 miles off the coast of Booth Bay Harbor. It's a really interesting place if you haven't been there. It's 4 square miles. No cars are allowed. There's only one ferry in and one ferry out. And I went there. I was looking for a remote place to set a story. And I thought, this is a really good place. And as I started to, I think that's my, I actually feel like I'm on a TED Talk right now. I think that's my beard, which I'm just getting used to. Anyway, it was a perfect setting. It was nice and isolated. I wanted a place where there was a small local community that stayed all year round, and then obviously lots and lots of tourists that come in the summer. And I wanted to set it at the very end of that tourist season, when the locals who are living there are both excited to have the summer people leave, but also there's some trepidation about being with just 100 people or 50 people. So I found Monhegan. There are about 50 people live on Monhegan. It's very beautiful, and I started to populate it with different characters, and they're all horrible. And so then I started asking myself different things about the island. Monhegan is so specific. It's so small and so specific that I wound up having to make some changes to it. I had to add a second island right next door that's connected with a bridge. I had to add an extra ferry line in and an extra service in. And once you start making those changes like that, you really have to. You can't really change something that's so. You can't change something that's so specific and still call it Monhegan. So I changed the name. To Finisterre, which means end of the world. And so whenever I talk to people who are from Maine or may have some love for Monhegan, I always say, well, all the beauty from that island is from Monhegan. All of the terrible people are from Maine.
It's very diplomatic. I love, though, how, like, infrastructure is difficult even when you're writing fiction.
Yes.
All right? I mean, like, we can't figure out how to, like, get our roads and trains working, and, like, you can't even make it work, you know, with the ferry and
no.
Yeah. One other thing I'm wondering, Edwin, is how different is this job from your old day job at a textbook publisher? I understand it was composition textbooks, right? So not... physics to fiction, but
yeah.
This must be quite
different.
It's a world
away. Can people still hear me? This thing is crazy. It's a world away. I was the editorial director at a major publisher, which basically meant I spent a lot of time managing people and looking at spreadsheets. Now I spend a lot of time with my imaginary friends.
And which is better? I mean, are there days when you want to go back to the day
job? I loved my job. I loved one of my colleagues this year, and you can report this back. I loved my job. But ultimately, does everyone know who Ron Swanson is from Parks and Recreation? He says you can't do two things half-assed. You have to do one thing whole-assed. And I decided, you know, ultimately I had to decide I was going to put my whole ass into writing.
I have to say... your book was probably the scariest for me to read because it involves missing children. And so as a parent of two little ones, that's a worse nightmare, obviously. And probably the same for any other parents who were reading your books, right? So, I mean, is that part of the deal when you're writing one of these, like, crime mystery thriller books? Like, find something that a lot of people are afraid of and really bring it to life?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you want to make something. Yeah. I don't have any kids, so I don't have that fear. But
I just push it.
Yeah. You want to find something that's going to resonate with your readers. And you know, for me, my stories are on the darker side. I have a contract with my readers. I've only written two books, but I have a contract with my readers that certain things are going to wind up okay in the end, but not everything's going to wind up okay in the end. Unfortunately, both of my books so far have involved children being in jeopardy. So we'll see if the third one does the same thing.
Kate, you also have something I think is pretty scary in your book. You've got a house for sale in Brookline. And even though the house is haunted, it still costs $4.3 million.
Yes, yes, it's true.
So, right? I mean, could there be a more frightening and accurate depiction
Boston,
of our real estate market?
Boston real estate, this is like a dark note to start on. Like, I might still be living in Boston if I could afford to live here. But so one of the, I lived here for 11 years. I worked in finance, and then I worked in fundraising, and I was a prospect researcher. Does anyone know what a prospect researcher is? Silence.
All right, from reading your book.
Yes. So prospect research is basically, in a fundraising office, they're the people in the back of the room who find all this publicly available information through the internet and write dossiers on incredibly wealthy people. So I had that job, and I found out an awful lot about Boston real estate and incredibly wealthy people in Boston. and I just wanted to write. I loved that job. That job was super fun. And I wanted to write about that as, like, this is the ideal amateur detective job springboard. So Tuesday Mooney, my main character, has this job, and she just is thrust into this game that this incredibly wealthy wacko who loves Edgar Allan Poe devises as part of his will. He dies spectacularly in the first chapter, no spoilers, and he leaves behind a treasure hunt throughout the city. And like you said, Boston, I lived here for 11 years. It changed dramatically in that time. You know, seeing what was gentrified, what was up and coming, and like I really wanted to write about that, but also write about the old Boston that still is visible under everything. Like when you're down in the T, like you see like decades of dirt, first of all, but you see how the city, the parts of the city that are still there and grimy underneath all this gentrification and wealth.
So I feel obligated to ask, since there is this haunted house in
the
book, do you believe in ghosts? And have you had any paranormal experience
So I live in this like crazy old house in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania now that
it was a
steel baron's house. It has now been chopped up into apartments. And after I had moved in there, I thought I heard this noise, but it turned out to just be my cat. So no, I have not actually had any paranormal experiences. But I love it. Love thinking about them. And it's part of that history thing, too. Like, ghosts. I watched Ghost Hunters all the time for, like, 3 years. And what I loved the most about that show, aside from the fact that, like, the show was literally just them walking around and being like, did you hear that? And then nothing happens. but they went to these incredible old houses and penitentiaries and asylums. And I was like, it's amazing. History is a ghost everywhere. Yes, so...
All right, so I mentioned the eclectic resume at the top,
yes.
And I, as promised, I have to ask, what does a planetarium operator do?
Well, she is a teenager who has a summer job at a science museum, and she plays her cassette tapes, because it's the 90s, really loud on the speakers while she's setting up the planetarium for the next show. But yeah, the person there literally just turns on the sky when it comes up on the tape and has like a little red pointer beam and is like, that's, you know, Ariadne, and that's... I don't even remember. I always did like the summer show, but anyway, that's what she does. She sits in the booth and feels very important.
So I ask partly out of curiosity, but also partly because I'm wondering whether having a lot of different jobs and a lot of different life experience, I mean, does that help you in your writing? Because this book is got quite the eclectic cast of characters, right? So does that help you kind of get in the headspace to imagine and create each of those characters?
Absolutely. Yeah, I am a very inquisitive, creative person who gets bored super easily. So I've had many, many jobs in my life. And in every job, if I liked it or if I didn't, I always learned something and I always meet extraordinary people. And that kind of multiplicity of experience is where I write from, right? Like, I just get curious about people. I get curious about life. I get curious about places. And yeah, it's also, like, writing for me, first of all, it's like a coping mechanism that, that I've developed for being alive and being a person who notices everything and wants to think about it. But writing for me is also a way to explore what I'm curious about and to just like discover that on the page. So that's having lots of jobs. Also, it's tons of material.
So on the job front, I have a question really for all of you, mm-hmm. which is that I believe that all of you either currently do or have in the past had to balance your novel writing ambitions with a day job, with another career. And I suspect that there are some people in the audience who may be in the same position. Maybe you came to the book festival and you want to be writing, or maybe you are already writing your own book. So I'm wondering what kind of advice you can give for those folks. And maybe we'll just go down the line, Adam. I mean, for folks who are trying to get into the novel writing game, but they say, how on earth am I ever going to find the time?
Consistency, good coffee, and weed. Really. And I'm not kidding. I mean, that's it. Don't try to write high, but definitely edit high. You'll find the bullshit in your writing very clearly. And that's what I do.
Hank, that's hard to follow, but really, this has been quite a second act for you. You had one fantastic career on TV, and I imagined, were you always thinking at that point, I want to write the novel, and then you finally got around to it? I mean, how did it go?
Yes and no. I grew up in really rural Indiana, and my sister and I used to ride our ponies to the library to get books, and we'd fill up the saddlebags with books and read. No, I'm serious. I'm totally serious. Cadet and Sable were their names, and we'd fill up the saddlebags with books and read in the hayloft in the barn behind our house. And I love Nancy Drew, and I love Sherlock Holmes, and all the Golden Age mystery writers, Agatha Christie and Niall Marsh and Josephine Tay. And I really fell in love with the music, the architecture of the mystery, how a really good author could lure you in, and then in the end, surprise you with an ending that was sort of inevitable, but so surprising that if you had only been as smart as the author, you could have figured it out. And I wanted to do that, but I kind of had this thought of maybe it would be just as much fun to be Nancy Drew as to write about Nancy Drew. So I became an investigative reporter, which is kind of the same. And then not till I was 55, 15 years ago, did I start writing crime fiction. And I wondered whether, at that point, whether my brain could make stuff up. I've wired myself with hidden cameras and confronted corrupt politicians and gone undercover and in disguise and chased down criminals. But in television reporting, you tell the truth, so the dialogue is what people say, the setting is what really is. But to sit down in front of a computer and say, I'm going to make a new world now. Rachel and Jack and Martha in The Murder List, which one is the cat and which one is the mouse? I don't know. So it was really a joy to realize that my imagination would work that way, because I wasn't quite sure it would. And I think that the key to your question finally is I was naive. I was naive enough to think I could write a book. And I said to my husband, I've got a great idea. I'm going to write a novel. And he says, great. He said, do you know how to write a book? And I said, dumb me, I said, how hard can it be? I've read a million of them. And I learned that, as you say, it is hard. And it's just like math. You just sit down at your desk, and no one cares if you do it except for you. So be your own boss and just advance the story, just like in television. Advance the story. And I don't want you to, I want you to miss your stop on the T when you're reading The Murder List. I don't want you to turn the channel when you're watching my stories. And it's the same kind of storytelling.
We call them driveway moments in public radio.
Exactly. Where people have to sit in their car.
Yeah, exactly.
Hear the end of your story.
So that's interesting. So in a lot of ways, it sounds like the author dream predated the reporter's dream. But are you a better writer now for having had the long career as a reporter? You know what I mean? That life experience, would your novels be as good if you had written them when you were 25?
Really quickly, first of all, thank you for saying I'm a better writer. Thank you for saying my novel's as good as that. We all pick out all the blurbs whenever we possibly can. If somebody says something good, I'm going to take that. I am the luckiest person in the world because I've spent the last 43 years telling stories with a beginning, middle, and end, with a problem that needs to be solved, with the character that you care about. And in the end, You know, you want the good guys to win and the bad guys to get what's coming to them in investigative reporting or in crime fiction. And I learned how to tell a story that will change your life and will change the world. When you finish the murder list, I want you to say, wow, I didn't see that coming. And I also want you to say, I'm going to look at the world a little bit differently. I'm going to see how justice works or doesn't in a different way. So they're kind of Trojan horses of really a good story, I hope. But I learned, and some bigger picture meaning that I want you to take that's sort of more than the book. And I learned that in television. Of course, I learned that as a reporter, how to take a very complicated, fascinating thing and just take the jewels from it and put those together. And that's what crime fiction is.
Edwin, you said earlier it helps to just sort of go all in, you know, on the writing. But that can be hard. I mean, you got bills to pay, right? So when do you know that it's okay to make that switch, right? I mean, if I understand your background, right, the novel writing kind of started as a side hustle. You're doing it while you're also holding down the day job. And then at some point, you make the leap. When do you know that it's okay to make the leap and you're not just stepping off a cliff?
I don't know if I've figured that out yet, actually. So, I mean, the bottom line is that I have a contract with a publisher. I have to write a book a year. And I get to write a book a year. That is actually true. Thank you. This is a privilege that has been given to me, and I have to take advantage of it. And I think my first book, like every first novelist, nobody was interested. Nobody cared. And I could have worked on it for 1,000 years, and nobody would have cared. My second book was very different. This one, I wrote under contract while working a very full-time job, and it was extremely challenging. And I kind of got to the end of that process, and I thought, I have a third book under contract. Can I go through that again? And can I actually deliver something that's good? And the answer was flat out no. And at that point, I just had to make that decision. For anyone out there who's trying to write, I have four pieces of advice. First one is you're going to hear advice from a million people. Pick and choose whatever you want to use and throw away the rest. You're only going to use about 5% of this. The second thing is come up with achievable goals. If you're working a full-time job and you're trying to write at the same time, make sure that you can achieve whatever it is that you've set out to do. If it's writing 100 words a week, fine. At least you've written 100 words that week. The second thing is look for small successes wherever you can. A couple years ago, I was really on the edge of giving up on this. And I submitted some papers, pages to a conference that we host here in Massachusetts called the Crime Bank. And Hallie Efron, who was here earlier today doing another session, Hallie Efron happened to read them. And she said, these are awesome. And you know what? I still didn't sell the book for 2 more years, but I always held on to those words. And, you know, so sell a little short story, sell a little essay, write something on a blog, get some good feedback. And the third thing is, if I can do this, I'm like the world's stupidest person. If I can do this, I am telling you, you can do this too.
I think Emerson's MFA program would like to have a word with you. Kate, I want to be sure I get you on this question, too, because this is part of what you do, right, at Grub Street. So you're the perfect person to address this, and you teach some online classes for these aspiring writers. I mean, and you're very much in the game yourself, sort of straddling these two worlds. You got the library day job. You're writing the novel. How do you do it?
I have a lot of thoughts and feelings about day jobs and writing lives. How long do you have? No. So my first two books, I worked full-time when I wrote them. I wrote them on the weekends. They took about 3 years to write a single draft and like one kind of good revision, which it feels like forever, but actually kind of isn't. Like it goes by very quickly. After my second book came out in 2014, and I was like, I think I'm gonna do this. But I can't do it in Boston because I can't afford to take this leap here. So I moved to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and completely fell apart. Writing the book isn't just the work of, I have an idea and I'm sitting and I'm down, I'm doing it. It's the structure of your life. It's the other things you have in place that make the writing both possible and imperative. I had a full-time job. I didn't have to worry about where the money was coming from for rent. I could, on the weekends, just relax and, like, play. And that, I totally recommend reading Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own. It changed my life. And she her recommendation there is that, specifically for women to join the canon and, not, like, have the time, not join the canon, that's a whole other thing, but for specifically for women to be able to produce work, they need to have a space of their own, a room of one's own, where they don't have to worry. There's not, you know, someone to pick up from school. There's not dinner to get on the table. They can just go there and be themselves and write. And full-time jobs for me were a room of my own. I didn't have to worry about that. I could go do it. So, of course, then I got rid of the full-time jobs, and I was like, ah! So, but, you know, I found new structures. I work part-time at the library. I love working at the library. It's such a great place to work, specifically my library, libraries in general. I love teaching at Grub Street. I love talking with other writers and having that kind of writer interaction with people. And I love, like, living in a small town. The biggest I would add, those are great pieces of advice. The other piece of advice I would add, if you, two pieces. One, to be a writer, keep a low overhead life. I have a very low overhead life. My only asset is my car, and it's 10 years old. and the other piece of advice is that there are a lot of, I think, really harmful myths and romances about what a writing life looks like. It looks like, you know, hanging out in a cabin, like in Love Actually, when Colin Firth, like, goes out to
write
his book.
That's exactly what I was picturing,
that
by
is
the way.
That is not the writing life. I mean, but maybe it is for him, actually, because, like, any life in which you are writing is a writing life. You just have to find the balance that makes it possible for you to do it in a way that you feel supported and like things are possible, right? And then it's all pattern. It's all habit. It's all just like, it's like going to the gym. It's like, I got up today and this is what I do on Saturdays. I go and I write. And then eventually you write a book.
I mean, it's so interesting because it's so easy not to do it. It's so easy to come up with something else to do. And it's all, you know, procrastination, which is what that is all about fear. You know, can I not do it? How everybody else is doing it? This is really difficult. Maybe, you know, one day I decided I was going to go alphabetize my spices because I really, you know, you can come up with stuff. But the key is that you have to make your writing be the priority of your life. You know, and if you can do that, even for this, for a chunk of time in a day, 2 hours, don't come talk to me. Don't come in here. Mm-hmm. Don't be on the internet. Don't be on email. Don't be, you know, on whatever you do. Don't do that. You're going to write your book because this is the most important thing to you. And, you know, to me, the writing life is making that decision to commit to it. And be a professional about it. It's your job. And once you kind of do that, you get, don't you think you get sort of filled with the idea that, yes, I can do it just like all those people can do it.
If you're miserable when you're not writing, you're a writer. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's essentially it. Yep. Because it's just something that you're compelled to do, whether or not it's ever going to be seen. You do it because otherwise you're, like I said, you're just miserable. And so I live in a constant state of misery. And once in a while, things come up and you get a book and you hope to attract women and, you know, all the things that come with it. But for the most part, it's extremely difficult to balance. I mean, believe it or not, I do have a job. So it is, it's hard to balance. I find the mornings before the real world comes in. So wake up and do all those things I talked about before. But before the real world comes in, it's your own world.
Hank mentioned the internet, too. Oh, my gosh, turn the internet off. It's the worst. treat your computer like it's a typewriter. Yeah. Like,
because it's a distraction away from the... Okay.
Mm-hmm. Not, because it feels like you're doing something. It feels like you're typing. You know, and you don't, in real life, in writing a book, and that cursor is like, now you know why it's called a cursor. Because, oh my gosh, you can't think of anything. But the internet, you know, you're on Facebook, you're just typing stuff up, and it feels like you're working, but you're not working. Nothing is, no writing is happening in that time.
Okay, but if you use the typewriter, we learned from the Colin Firth reference earlier that if you use the typewriter, writer and your manuscript blows into the lake, you have to jump in, right? I mean, that's the, so there's another lesson in there too. I have another question for our panelists, but I want to make sure you all are brainstorming.
But then he says, oh, it's all trash. Doesn't matter. And that's how you feel too.
And I'm getting the girl out of it, Adam. So actually it doesn't end too badly. Brainstorm your own questions, by the way, because in a couple of minutes we're going to open it up for audience questions. Tiffany, could you wave? Okay, Tiffany at the back, if you have a question, wave Tiffany down and she will escort you to the microphone. But while you folks are thinking about that, let me just ask each of you what we should be expecting next. I imagine the wheels are always turning about what the next project is going to be. Kate, what's coming next?
So the Tuesday Mooney world is actually kind of built to scale. It is kind of like a Sherlock Holmes, Indiana Jones universe, where I could write another book in the series, but as soon as I finish this one, as soon as you finish any book, you're like, oh my God, I need something else. So I am working on something else. I don't quite know what it is. Alexander Chee has this great piece of advice that, like, when people ask you what you're working on, you can lie to them. You're like, I'm working on a space opera.
I love that.
Right? But maybe I would.
It's
but,
a good line of cocktail parties, though, right?
So, yeah. But I am working on something. It'll happen.
Can we get that on T-shirts? Like, working on something, it'll
happen. It'll happen.
I like that. Edwin, what are you working on?
I'm working on, I have a third Hester Thursby book coming out. Hester Thursby is a researcher at Harvard, and she finds missing people on the side. This one actually stays in Boston. Most of the action takes place in Jamaica Plain. And it involves a for-profit college, which is like the University of Phoenix. It's a college that's run by stockholders instead of academics. And the school is kind of going down the tubes. The head of the school hires Hester to find a list of students that they don't have enough data on. And as she digs into the students, she finds out that most of them don't exist. And the few people on the list that do exist start dying off.
I like it.
Yes, and I just remembered, the whole thing starts out with a dead baby. Sorry.
Three in a row, Edwin, with the danger to children. Oh my God! Yeah, but actually, though, this is very sort of very on the news, though, in a way. Not the dead baby, but the but the struggling colleges and for profit, right? I mean, is that part of it? I imagine that helps the book feel more real because people are reading about these kinds of things in current events anyway.
Yeah, I mean, so, especially when you're writing a series, it's good to pull. It's nice to pull out something that's current or. As long as it's still, because you turn over a book and it takes a year for it to publish. So, you know, once in a while you'll pick a current event that doesn't, it feels very old-fashioned a year later. So you just have to be mindful of that.
In my first book, I had all kinds of cultural references that my editor took them all out. And she said, it'll really date your book. And I said, come on, Jane Pauley is also always going to be the anchor of the Today Show. Come on. And of all those references, all those popular references, the only person she let me keep in was Oprah, which I thought was pretty interesting. Oprah is forever, apparently.
She's eternal.
Exactly. Yeah. I realized the other day when you asked what I was working on, I realized the other day that what I write is cat and mouse games. And the reader has to decide which one is the cat and which one is the mouse. So in my book, Trust Me, it's two people. In The Murder List, it's a triangle. In my new book, The First to Lie, it's four people. Or it might be two people. You don't know. And the idea for the book was that it was going to be like, the daughter of a Sackler-type family gets revenge by bringing down her company, her family's business. So now it's not like that. It's not about that at all. But that was the idea. And it is due Tuesday. So gotta go.
So sign those books quickly afterwards. She's gotta go. Adam, what are you working on next?
Too many ideas, too little time. Boston needs a good serial killer, pro sports mashup, but that's just one idea. But I'm working on a memoir of, I was a mover in Boston for many years. That would be mover, not movies. So humping furniture and people from place to place. So working on a memoir for those years. And it was a crazy company that still exists. But that's what I'm working on now.
I bet it's going to be good, too, because as a mover, you must walk into some strange homes, probably some super rich people's homes that have all kinds of stuff.
Everybody moves. It's like death or taxes. At one point or another, for some reason, everybody moves, and everybody moves for a big reason. You see all your stuff. You know somebody as soon as you walk into their house. You know exactly what they're about, and that's without even going through their drawers. Absolutely. We did. By the way, porn weighs a lot. All right, just so you know. It's true.
You've been warned.
You're so terrible.
It's awesome.
All right. Tiffany is out there. Tiffany, do we have some folks with questions?
Hi, I have a question. I am writing a book, and it's autobiographical. I had a stroke, and I'm writing it from the perspective of coming back from it. And what I'd like to know is the workshop that you talked about, would I be able to do that?
What workshop?
Grub
Street? Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Grub Street has some great memoir-specific programs. You can take one-day classes. You can take six-day classes. Six-week classes, 10-week classes, and they have stuff online, too, that you can take whether you live in Boston or if you live in Timbuktu.
Okay.
Great. Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome. It's grubstreet.org.
Kate, if you don't already have, a finder's fee in your contract, make sure you add that,
boom.
Right? Because, out of the room, when you start bringing in the business, you need to be getting a piece of it. Tiffany, who's next?
Thank you. So being a Bostonian, one of the things I like about local books is I recognize all the places in them. That's why I like the Spencer book so much. But nothing will kill a book for me more is when an author makes an historical or geographical mistake in a book. It just kills it. I won't mention the book, but there's one where there was an accident in Harvard Square. The injured went to Mount Auburn Hospital, and the author had the ambulances going down Storrow Drive. Wrong side of the river. So having said that, I'm just curious, especially, and this is for Kate, since she no longer lives here, and she's not a native. Do you take any precautions when you write about Boston or any other local area to make sure that you're accurate in your geographical and historical facts?
This is a very good question, and this is now an opportunity for me to confess to everyone. So I do take precautions. I mean, I lived here for 11 years. The apartment my character lives in is my apartment. The office she works in was my office. I always caution people against writing characters from people, but write places from places you've been. And I looked at maps and I checked stuff out and I made sure things were accurate. But you live someplace, you love someplace, you kind of stop seeing it. And I did not notice that I had made an error like that until I was going through my ARC to figure out what I was going to read at readings. And this is my fault, but I'm also going to blame my copy editor, who lives in Boston, and should have caught that I called it Tremont Station instead of Boylston Station. It's on Tremont Street. So I think that's the only mistake, and I hope you could enjoy the book otherwise. I was going through, this is okay, this is okay. And then I got to that, and I was like, oh, my God.
If you make mistakes like that, believe me, you will hear about them. My current book has a mistake. I had a character get on the 88 bus when she should have gotten on the 90 bus, and I've received a number of emails about that.
Yeah. All of my bus lines are 100% accurate.
there's a couple of really interesting things about that. When you're writing about a real place, I'm careful to make it be the real place. But when there's a murder or say food poisoning in a hotel when someone dies, I'm not going to have it be at the Mandarin. That's just not. I sort of take Boston geography and open it up a little bit. And put in a new street and put in a place that you might not know. Or in Brookline, stick a street in Brookline. Because if somebody is murdered in a certain house, say 473 Kilsyth Road, I don't want somebody to say, I live there, you know, that didn't happen. So you have to be pretty careful about that. The other thing about Bostonianness is that we call things that other people might not call them. So I had written Boston Garden in a book, and my copy editor said, it's not called Boston. It's not Boston Garden. It's whatever it is. TD Garden, is that what it is now? Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah, but I don't call it TD Garden. I call it Boston Garden. It's always been Boston Garden. And so we compromised on calling it, I think, the place where they play basketball or something like that. You know, just something. And like, I called it Dunkin's. She went to Dunkin's to get a coffee regular. And my editor said, what is that? So you have to... Our books are read by people across the country, around the world, and so there are some things that are Bostonian that we can keep and some that we have to think about whether somebody might just not understand that. What should I have called it? The garden? What should I have called it? Yeah.
The garden. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to call her.
When it was the Fleet Center for a hot second, yeah, though, that was, yeah, forget that. But seriously, I mean, this is sort of a particular thing to Boston, though, Adam, I think, in a way. I mean, I imagine that everybody has some pride in their own city, but I feel like Boston is, like, extremely parochial in this way. Is that?
Absolutely. I mean, the changes that the city has undergone has really changed the way that it looks. But as far as accuracy goes, I mean, I don't count the fire hydrants, even though I did put in a number at some point. To me, it's about getting the feel right. Like, my books are really it's a love letter to the city that just chewed me up and spit me out. So I want that feeling to be right. So I might get a street wrong. I don't know. No one's ever called me on it. I don't think I did. But to me, it's just getting that feel. Like, oh, I know what it's like to. I walked down this street at this time. I felt what he's feeling. So I don't know about historical accuracy, but certainly accuracy of the heart was important to me.
I think we've got time for a couple more. Tiffany, do we have some? Oh, down here. Great.
Hello. So when choosing an area for the book to take place, in these cases Boston, is it as a necessity to the plot, a familiarity with the place, or just a love of the place?
I'll start. So when I wrote my first two books, I was working a full-time job. And so I chose only places that I knew very well because I wanted to minimize you always have to do research, but I was trying to minimize research as much as possible. So Hester and her partner live in a house, and that house was, when I started working on this book, that was the house next door to mine. And then I just chose various parts of New England that I knew well. In my first book, I really wanted to explore economic disparity. So a lot of the action takes place on Beacon Hill, where you have economic disparity. And then when we leave Boston, a lot of the action takes place in the Lakes region, where, again, you have a lot of rich people, and you have a lot of people who don't necessarily have as much money. So those were the decisions that went into that.
Yeah, for me, it was definitely familiarity. I wanted to know. I wanted to use what I had learned in my jobs in finance and fundraising, what I learned, you know, after 11 years in Boston. But I also was not living here anymore, and I missed it so much. So it's definitely a book I wrote also as a love letter to, like, the experiences I had, the things that I had known, the people that I love still. To Boston, and it's a little rose-colored glasses. Like, I wrote this scene in Park Street where I was like, it's so beautiful, and like, look at how vivid and lovely it is, and like, it is Park Street. So like, I that was when I was like, oh, you're grieving. It's okay, honey. Write the book. Like, it's a very powerful motivator, grief.
And what I want you to do, especially people who live in New England, is to be able to make a little movie in your mind of the book. And so that's how I write it. Sometimes I close my eyes and very briefly and see where the action is happening and envision that you in the State House. There's a lot of scenes in the murder list in the State House and the beautiful stained glass door on the Senate window, and you open the door and there's the Arabella and the Mayflower and the turquoise glass, and I know what that looks like now. And so I like to make you feel that you have been there. And I, you know, after having worked in Boston all these years, my stories are set here. I mean, people say, do you do a lot of research on your books? And I say, I've been doing research for 43 years. You know, I just should have written it down. That's the thing. But it feels natural to me to have Rachel and Jack and Martha, you know, fight it out at the Suffolk County Courthouse and fight it out in the State House and on that, you know, the hill going up past Number 9 Park and how the water drips from the air conditioner on the sidewalk onto your head in the summer. Yep. You know, those real things that happen. Yeah, I love it.
We got time for one more.
In the way back.
I'm just curious because of the fact that this is a panel with mystery writers on it. Are you guys plotters or are you pantsers?
Well, writing to me, I mean, I'm not a plotter, actually, unless you're doing it with two D's and not two T's. So I actually, it's a daily miracle for me. I know that people do plot, but I get up and I sit down. I get up in the morning and then when I sit down to write, I literally don't know what's coming next. I mean, a story has to move forward, and you know that the character's going to do something, but honestly, I don't plot it out. So I just heard an interview with Martin, whatever, who does the Fire and Ice series.
George
R. Martin, right? And he, that guy. He said there are two kinds of writers, and it was interesting. He said there are architects, those who plot, and then there are gardeners who just, they plant a seed and something grows. And I just heard that recently, and I was like, wow, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
And I am certainly not an architect. So,
I mean, you know plotters and pantsers, right? Plotters that make an outline-ish, and pantsers who write by the seat of their pants. That's what he's asking about. I'm completely a gardener pantser, no question about it. And that's kind of what gets me to the computer every day. It's like, I wonder what's going to happen. And it's magic how things just evolve that I don't plan. And people say to me, you know, the end of the murder list, you really surprised me. And I'm like, yeah. Huda, did you think that would happen? Because I didn't know till I got to the point where I knew in the book what had happened. And that's, you know, Sue Grafton called that the magic of writing, that things occur in your subconscious that it lets you know about when it's time to know about it. So it's very exciting. Scary, a tightrope, but very exciting.
So do you know, you were teasing us earlier about your forthcoming book, about whether the cat and mouse game is between two people or four people. Was that for us to figure out, or are you still figuring that out?
You got me. It's I'm figuring that out.
We're all figuring it out.
We're all figuring that out. I'll know by Tuesday.
That's right. Edwin, plot or pants?
My dad loves to tell me that Robert Parker used to write a chapter a day and he'd never revise it again. I don't know if he's trying to motivate me when he tells me that. I'm not either a plotter or a pantser. I do come up with some plot points that I sort of write to, and they change constantly. So I guess I sort of do both.
My first draft is a total pantser. I know who the characters are, I know where they are, and I kind of know like what my absurd final like showdown set piece is going to be. But I didn't for this book, so that's a lie. But I am a gardener. I love that. That's really great. For the first draft, like it is just a crazy kitchen sink. Put every like idea and thought you have in it. And then my second draft is a plotter draft. That's when I go back in and I'm kind of like, well, this is banana pants. Like, take that out. And you have, I need to have something to work with to build, to be an architect.
But you do your first draft and you see what your story is.
Yes, exactly.
And then you see all the things that you didn't need in that.
Yeah,
and you
exactly.
take those out and you see the story that you meant to write. And that's great.
Yeah.
Well, this was a lot of fun. Thank you all for your time.
That's Thank you.
All the time that we have. I just want to remind you all that the authors will be available after this session downstairs. You can purchase the books, which they will also sign for you if you ask very nicely. Once again, the novels are Tuesday Mori, Talks to Ghosts by Kate Reculia, The Missing Ones by Edwin Hill, The Murder List by Hank Philippi Ryan, and A Town Called Malice by Adam Abramowitz. Thank you all for coming.